Hello there and welcome along to the RTE Rugby Podcast. Neil Tracy here with you and joined again by the new two Johnnies, Holland and Murphy, to talk through all the news from the world of rugby this week. A couple of Johnnies seem to be leaving RTE, but this is the way forward now, these two Johnnies. The Investec Champions Cup final this Saturday, Leinster and Toulouse live on RTE2. We'll also look back on last week's URC, because while it is Champions Cup final weekend, there was a lot at stake last weekend in the URC, and there is a lot at stake heading into the final round of regular season games next week as well. I'm going to start this week with a question and discussion point around rugby and some of the unwritten rules in society. So I'm going to give you an example here. On Sunday just gone, I was going to Bruce Springsteen in Croke Park, and I was going with my brother and his wife. And we were walking from O'Connell Street up Summer Hill up towards Croke Park, and there was these two fellas just ahead of us talking about rugby. And they were talking about the potential of where Munster could be playing a URC final if they get there. And would they be allowed to play it at Thomond Park, or would it have to be played at a bigger stadium or somewhere? And one of them said, do you not remember in the 2017 final when they had to play it at the Aviva because Thomond Park was too small? And then he was trying to remind his friend about it. He said, you remember, it was Paul O'Connell's last game for Munster. So there's two points there that obviously jumped out. Number one, while they played the 2017 Pro 12 final against the Scarlets at the Aviva Stadium, that final had been decided 9 months in advance. It had nothing to do with Thomond Park being too small. And secondly, Paul O'Connell's last game for Munster was the 2015 final. Now, me and my brother were standing behind them listening to all this, and we ended up having a discussion of, do you ever end up in this situation where you overhear someone having a conversation about rugby and they're just getting some facts wrong, and it takes every fiber of your being not to just lean across and say, hi mate, sorry to interrupt here, but I just overheard you, and I think you'll find Paul O'Connell's last game for Munster was actually in 2015. And it was nothing to do with Thomond Park being too small for that final either. Now, I didn't do it in the end, but God almighty, it was a tough situation. And I find I end up in this situation quite a lot, where you overhear someone just getting a couple of facts wrong. And like, is it polite? Is it rude to lean across and just quietly correct them? Does anyone want to come in on this? Or
I think you have to remember who you're speaking to. So you're speaking to a Kildare man and a Cork man. So the Cork man answer is going to be very different to the Kildare man, I think.
Say that, Johnny.
I think, it can be very hard, but I'm kind of happy enough to blend into the background, where, you know, historically and my experience of doing a two-centered approach for 5 years, there's, a certain area in the country that can be quite opinionated at times. But but the majority of the time I found that they're generally quite right, which is quite interesting. So I'm going to slag, but then leave that there as well for you, Johnny, so you can take the olive branch that I've given you there.
No olive branch there from what I've heard. But I think, you know what, Neil, the game is so, things like, you know, that's why the stadium was picked. Like, that's just silly. Like, you know, people have their opinion and they talk about the game. And rugby probably does have a bit of a following where
this is how misinformation gets out there, Johnny. Like, you know,
there's a lot of chat around rugby, and even like when you're trying to understand the game, and you could overhear people talking about the game, or they might tell you like he did this and he did that. Like a very good lesson for me was that I was up in Munster's training centre at one stage, and we were looking back at last season's semi final of how Munster wanted to keep the ball on the pitch, but I can guarantee you 90% of rugby following would say, Jesus, you know, Jack Crowley or Joey Carberry or Ben Healy or whoever is missing touch here. You know, Conor Murray didn't put the ball into touch. And we just don't know. Even like when we're analysing games and we're, you know, pundits of some form, we have an opinion on it, but I always try and be careful that like we actually don't know what way they've set up, you know, so we can't, like, we can have an opinion. You have to have an opinion, obviously, and everyone's entitled to that as well, of how the game is played out. And you can say they should be hitting touch, but we can't say that he missed touch, you know what I mean? So like, you do have to have a kind of an understanding that we don't know all of what's going on, and it is a complex game, isn't it? So like, try not to obviously get involved with that, but like, you do hear some things at times and it would frustrate you, but I'm sure I frustrate people too.
Yeah, but I think a perfect example of that is like the South African thing during the World Cup, like when they take that free kick off the mark, when they take the penalty off the mark, and everyone was like, "What the? Like, this is ridiculous! Like, what, you know?" And then you look at the documentary and what the thought process that went into that, the plan that went into that, and because of that now, people are saying, "Oh, they're bringing in the IRB, they're bringing in a South Africa rule to stop that," but like. It's as Johnny says, we just don't know behind closed doors what the tactics are or what, and you pick up those things when you do that stuff. Like Johnny says, you go into organizations and you see what they're planning, and people can consistently say, well, why are they coming back down the short side, or why are they doing this? So that's ridiculous. They need to be going to width, but they're playing this hard up D, and it's like, well, you have to shorten them, so it's just as Johnny says, even though we analyze the games. We don't really know ourselves sometimes,
But saying things that are factually incorrect, Neil, is
Oh,
that is
yeah.
yeah, like the round stadium stuff and people's last game and stuff. That's silly.
Yeah, so basically what I'm trying to get around to is I didn't have the balls to correct your man on the spot, and I'm just hoping he listens to the
I'm
podcast.
glad you called him out on the podcast now in front of everyone. It's great.
I just didn't want to do it. What no one knows who this guy is. Only he knows who he is if he's listening to the podcast today. So if you are listening, Paul O'Connell, his last game for Munster was 2015. Pardon?
In Ravenhill.
Yeah, the 2015 final. And the Aviva Stadium was decided for the Pro 12 final that year at the start of the season. So I just needed to get all that off my chest, and now we can get into the rugby. So,
There's one other one in Ravenhill. Johnny, we were on the bench, and was it Duncan came on and got injured straight away?
yeah.
And I had played about three games for Munster, and it was this big thing, which Johnny is going to go on at nine? And you, in all your power, tried to throw me under the bus, and I think you were the one chosen afterwards to go on at nine. Did you end up going on, or did Duncan struggle through?
I think Duncan struggled through, but I was like literally one of those moments. I was like,
You were like, it's the
yeah, I was like, it's definitely the other
other
Johnny.
guy,
It's
yeah.
not
And I'll tell
me.
you, it wouldn't have gone well because there was a pre-season, or there was actually wasn't pre-season, in the middle of a season at one stage, and I was younger at that time, and Duncan Casey's, they needed someone feeding the ball into some scrums. They had no nines, and they were like, come over and feed the ball into the scrum. So I was like, geez, I don't know what to do here. You think it's so simple. And Duncan Casey said to me, just wait for me to put up my foot. And I didn't know what he meant, so I just nodded. And the two scrums engaged, and I just like didn't know what to do. It kind of felt a bit awkward, so I just lashed the ball in, and it came out the other side of the tunnel. And Duncan was like, I fucking told you to wait till my foot came up. So if I did that in Ravenhill, it would have been your fault.
Yeah, okay, I'll take that one. I'll take that. There's a lot that we can go into on the scrums and stuff. I packed out against Bourgoin in someone got we got someone sent in, and Leo was actually on the pitch, and I ended up scrummaging at blindside flanker on Leo's ass rather than Castro's ass, and there was this massive hole on engage, and I was like, that's not supposed to be there. And the scrum went straight down, and I went, uh-oh.
Yeah.
Uh-oh. We ended up getting a penalty, but needless to say that the highlight of the review meeting on the Monday morning was Cocker's absolutely abusing me in the main meeting about my scrummaging technique, because I was scrummaging on the second row's ass rather than the prop's ass.
It's like that. It's like that great clip of it. Was it Johnny May? I think in a game for England against Japan, where he ended up just putting his he had to go in as a back row for one of the scrums because of the yellow card, and he ended up I think just kind of like getting on his hands and knees in between whoever it was at flanker. It was ridiculous. So what you're saying in a roundabout way, lads, is the 2E would be useless in the modern game of a 6-2 split.
Pretty much, yeah. No hope.
Right, let's move it on to Leinster and Toulouse then. The Champions Cup final, I think, lads, everyone wanted pretty much from the outset. Maybe you could throw La Rochelle into the mix as well, but it's a three-pronged attack on the Champions Cup between La Rochelle, Toulouse, and Leinster, and nine titles between them. Leinster going for their fifth, Toulouse going for their sixth. Where'll we start? Johnny Murphy, I'll go to you first. Obviously, we'll talk a little bit later about Leinster and Ulster and their URC game at the weekend and Ulster's win. It's pretty obvious though, Leinster have put all the chips in on winning a Champions Cup. And if they lift the trophy on Saturday evening, we're all going to say, look, well done. You took the risk last week with the team selection. It paid off. You have the trophy. If it doesn't work out this weekend, they're in trouble on two fronts. That's the risk you got to play, though, is it?
Yeah, I think so. But like, I think the, you know, there wasn't, like previous years, there wasn't a massive, like as in, okay, there was plenty of rotation, but you look at who played, James Ryan, Keenan, you know, Jimmy O'Brien, all got game time that would be potentially in the shakeup for the 23. You have a back row, you know, Conan got time. Will Connors is now back in the, you know, back in the thought process. So they were priming people as well that would potentially be coming off the bench, or whether there was toss-ups of whether, you know, they're in the conversation around who's going to play, who's going to start. And yeah, I think that it is clear that this is the big one for them. And I think that their league form kind of dropping off in those games and they have rotated has probably shown that. Because in historically in the last number of years, that hasn't been the case. You know, so yeah, the pressure is on, but I think they know what they've done. They've planned, you know, they've strategically worked out who's playing, who's not, who's getting game time. And I suppose I think, you know, not going into last weekend too much, but I suppose their inaccuracies around, but at certain times, not being able to close that game out, you know, the easy scores that they got themselves when they put the foot down. But this is it for them. Mm-hmm. I do think that it would be very hard to build themselves back up if they don't get over the line. Now, I might be wrong in that. But I think they're worthy favorites. You know, okay, they got through a semi-final, but you look at what they did against La Rochelle when the pressure was on them as well. You know, like, this is a team that has delivered on that, and it's all going to come down to, I think, their defensive effort, particularly in and around the ruck. And you look at what they're doing and their dark arts in that space all season long. They've really taken a step forward there, and I think that's going to be the winning and losing of the game.
Staying on the last week's selection for a moment, Johnny Holland. The comparisons have obviously been made to last season when they rotated everyone before the semi-final against Munster, ahead of the Champions Cup final against La Rochelle, and the comparisons then to the semi-final against Northampton when they arguably looked quite rusty, having had a couple of weeks off in the lead up to that game. Looking back on it though, particularly for last year's one, where the, like, 2 weeks ago against the Ospreys in the URC, they did put out quite a strong team. So I suppose, is that one game a big difference between being fine-tuned and being rusty? Whereas you look back at last year, where they'd rested everyone for that Munster game, but the week previous against the Sharks, they had also rested the majority of those frontline players as well. So coming into last year's Champions Cup final, some of those guys hadn't played in 3 weeks, similar to the semi-final against Northampton, where they looked a little bit rusty. Coming into this, though, it's just 2 weeks. Like, is that one extra game over the course of those 2 weeks potentially the difference between being fine-tuned and rusty?
Yeah, probably. And like, 3 weeks is a long time in rugby when you're playing. I think 2 weeks can be as well, but when you're coming into a final like that, like, if you last Tadhg Furlong early with a calf injury or something silly like that, you'd feel like an awful dope, like, you know, if you're selecting a team. So you do have to be very careful. And the thing on the back of your mind as a coach would be, if I lose them, like, you know, what have I done? Like, what have I done? Because some of those players are like James Gibson Park. There was no way in the world he was going to play, you know? So you need certain fellas that had to be rested. But there's others then, I wonder, are they better off playing? Like, was Ross Byrne better off getting game time? I think some players need to play, you know. I think you have to gauge that, but again, only Leo knows who needs to play and who doesn't need to play. Obviously, their thought process was around Will Connors might play, give him a start, because otherwise he'd be rusty. He might actually start. I think he'd be involved, obviously, but like, he might actually start. James Ryan, Hugo Keenan, they ticked the box on that. As Johnny said, they gave the kind of fellas coming off the bench, Al Alatoa, and others, they gave them time. I think what you might have learned is that Jimmy O'Brien is going to be seriously unfortunate here, because they need cover at 10 if they go 6-2, which everyone is expecting. But is Cormac Foley the other one that gets him away with that, because he can get on the wing as well now and obviously do a very good job there. And then the other thing that what you're saying there, I think 2 weeks is necessary because for people like James at Gibson Park, they're probably going in looking at the video. Now they have to prep the other team to play against Ulster, but they have more time to really look at Toulouse inside out and not be rushing through a review of Ulster and then getting into the weekend and feeling like you're not fully there by Tuesday, we'll say. Whereas those that are off their feet could have spent the weekend or even earlier just getting their homework done and being fully, fully prepped. But it's interesting. I mean, the hindsight's going to dictate who was right and wrong, like, isn't it? That's how this thing works. You know, yeah. If they win it, people will say it was genius and it was the right thing to do. If they lose, we're back to what happened last year. But I think that's unfair. Like, you have to approach it some way. You know, they're being paid the big bucks to do it in their way. And if they win it, all credit to them. If they lose it, I don't think you can come back with hindsight and say they're silly to do so. Like, none of us are in a position to do it. But I think everyone will get it wrong in one direction or another, but they'll get it right once they lift the trophy. And I do think there's ferocious pressure on them to win this one. Maybe that desperation will be good for them, but maybe Jack Nienaber will bring a bit of a cup final mentality to them. But I was surprised, like, James Ryan, he'd probably start, won't he? He'd probably lead the team and everything else, and he didn't take his 3 points in front of the post to go 4 points ahead. Like, that's a guy who's actually going to be in the middle of all that decision making at this weekend, you know. So not doing it last weekend, you'd wonder about some of those things. And Leo actually said it in his interview after the game, you know, maybe we'll probably learn one or two things. Can't remember what his words were, but it seemed to me like he was talking about that moment, you know, going into a cup final. And cup finals are different. You take your 3 points. I think there's no other conversations there about Ramos, whether he'll start because they'll take their 3 points, you know, those kind of things. So, yeah, long-winded answer, I'm sorry, but like 2 weeks is definitely better than 3 weeks, but you do need the 2 weeks for fellas to be fully prepped to go on have an assault on that Champions Cup.
Yeah, and I think Toulouse did the exact same thing. Like, yeah. Toulouse did the exact same thing, except they're after getting away with it. You know, like, they had a lot of academy players on the bench, like a lot of Gif guys on the bench. And I think that they just got away with it. And they beat Montpellier, I think, like, who were struggling down the bottom. But, you know, Toulouse did it as well, but they won. So people aren't necessarily talking about it, you know. I think this had to happen. And Johnny's 100% right in everything he said there.
The hindsight, obviously, is, as you both mentioned, is huge as well. And like Johnny Holland, as you pointed out, like if Leinster had won at the weekend and picked a very strong team, but Tadhg Furlong had done his calf after 4 minutes and is out of the Champions Cup final, we would all be sitting here today saying, what on earth were they doing picking the first team at the weekend? And similarly then with hindsight, another thing you mentioned is the decision making and how they turned down that shot at goal to go 4 points ahead in the second half against Ulster and went for the corner instead, and how cup final rugby are going to take the points. But like the decision making is tricky even in a cup final. Like, you look at the La Rochelle game 2 years ago where they just took points and they took the 3-6-9 approach, and even after the game Ron Nogara was asked about it and he said he was more than happy for Leinster to keep taking those, to the point that I was wondering were La Rochelle actually were they being a little bit adventurous and taking more risks when the ball was in the kind of middle third of the pitch to basically say, well, if we give away a penalty here, we don't really worry about Leinster taking 3 points, but if we're giving away the penalty down towards the corner, they might kick and go for a line out and try score tries. Whereas last year, obviously, they, you know, their entire lead was built up off the back of tries, and had they gone on and won, it would have been brilliant. Finding that balance in the decision making and picking the right time to turn down 3 points and go for a corner is such an important part of the game.
It's huge, but like you'd even feel it when you're coaching at times when an opposition takes 3 points, you're like, geez, I'd give them that 3 points all day long.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the halfway line and kick into their half. You know, there's sometimes when you feel the opposition have you, but that's the psychology of the game, like, because they might not know, they might have felt they were lucky to get in and whatever else. So it's a very hard one. But I think, like, you know, in cup final rugby, you do go 3-6-9 until you do have to throw a shot, and you have to throw shots to win those games. So like, you do have to pick your moment to do it, but I don't think you can do it too freely. Like, you have to pick the right time, and that's the winning and losing of it, obviously. Like, you know, that's the leaders on the pitch, they're trusted to do that, but I don't think you can go, hey, we'd love to go 8-8 here and let's just kick to the corner and see what happens. Like, now they were very, very close to getting that ball try, and you'd back them normally, and I I was kind of talking about with different personnel, you know, they'll get over the line there, but also they're up against different personnel in Toulouse as well. Like, you know, so it's a very, very difficult one. But you do have to pick a time with the flow of the game. And I just felt like the time in the Ulster game, they weren't really getting the return. They weren't scoring as freely as they have in other weeks. So that was why I thought they should have taken the separation and the gap. And then it's a psychological blow to Ulster as well, because they feel like, oh, we need to go and score. So they get a bit more desperate and can't just kick the ball in the air and hope for a return to get a penalty to go ahead, you know. So the psychological battle of that and showing a team that they're a little bit more distant from you, because you might get the next opportunity then to put it to bed, as opposed to trying to force it.
Yeah, I think that sport in general, it's that like understanding that psychology. You look at the golf at the weekend, like Xander Schauffele, like Paul McGinley said it numerous times, the fact that the course was so open and people were scoring on it, he had to attack. He couldn't defend. And I think that's something that you just have to get that balance right. At the weekend, James Ryan felt, you know, if they attack here, they could kill the game off. It's done. 8 points, you know, they move on. But it is understanding those momentum shifts in finals are the winning and losing, particularly at teams like this, that there is nothing between, and it is going to come down to a decision by a referee, a decision by a captain to go for sticks, to not go. Like, that's sport. And, you know, sometimes, unfortunately, you might have taken the right decision given the context and the momentum, but on a results basis, it might be the wrong one. And that's what high level sport is. And we're going into a weekend of, in our game, the highest club level, you know, and against the best two teams, most consistent teams in Europe this year.
And then the other part that you have to factor in then is you could be taking your 3-6-9 and building up a fine, healthy lead. But if any team out there have the ability to hit you with 2-3 tries in the space of a few minutes, it's going to be Toulouse. You look back at the quarterfinal against Exeter in particular, and I think they were 19-17, something along those lines, down early in the second half, and 11 minutes later they were 45-19 ahead. They scored four tries in the space of 11 minutes and just blew the game apart. They didn't do it to the same extent against Harlequins a couple of weeks ago, but they did something similar, and you know, they were scoring their tries in bunches. And if you look back over their campaign, their ability to just for a team to think that they're in a game with Toulouse and 10 minutes later for it to be all but over, Johnny Holland, it really is remarkable, their ability to just blitz teams for tries in a few minutes. And I suppose that's the challenge that Leinster have, where if, and I would say when, because I think it's a big if to say Leinster are going to hold Toulouse tryless at any point in the game, but if and when Toulouse do get a try, it's to make sure that you don't let them in for another one soon afterwards. And I know it's a very simplistic way of looking at it.
Well, simple is the best way to look at it, because that's a psychological way that, you know, Leinster need to go into the game and think that one score never becomes two, and we don't compound and we don't give them their 10, 15 minute patch, because they will put up a score that's big enough to put you under pressure, like, you know. But I think that fear will drive Leinster in a positive way. You know, when you're fearful of a team that can score from everywhere, you have to be switched on at all times. And this is a very, very good Leinster side with unbelievable personnel in there. So, like, if you can get those guys mentally right with a small bit of fear in the back of their minds, you actually get a very good performance. So I think that fear of Toulouse being able to score from anywhere versus like a Northampton who can do that as well. You might have a fear over Northampton, but you have a fear over Toulouse. So sometimes it keeps you switched on at every part of the pitch. Up deep in their 22, you have to stay switched on. You know, so it might be a good thing for them. But I think on the other side of that, Toulouse can leak tries in a very short period of time as well. So like, I don't think Leinster need to force that in terms of do the kick to the corner. They'll get it from face play, you know. If you look at Hugo Keenan going down the short side back inside the Cormac Foley against Ulster, they'll get a load of those kind of tight plays. So I don't think they need to force it at all. I think they'll get the momentum on Toulouse. When Harlequins win that Toulouse, they sat back in defence, and you can't sit back against that Leinster attack because it will click, you know. So it's going to be, but I wonder, will it just be one of these, everyone's expecting, you know, 45-44 and we'll get 21-20, like from a bit of a boxing match, you know.
I do think that the transition game is going to be massively important. So it's how Leinster attack and how accurate they are, not giving them opportunities to get into their kind of free flow transition and it being helter skelter. But then exactly what Leinster want is to get that transition from D, put them under so much pressure, get them going backwards consistently, 4, 5, 6, 7 phases in a row, and then that'll either force them to kick or force that offload where then Leinster can transition into their attack and try and score within 2 or 3 phases off their transition. I think that's going to be a huge part of the game, that they can't give to lose easy outs when they have them under pressure going back for that 5th, 6th, 7th phase. Let them get an offload, someone shoot ahead of the guy in front of them, give him an offload channel and then go, and then they're up the guts of them. They have to manage that, be patient in their D, and I think the transition game is where it's going to be. You know, I personally think it's going to be won and lost on that.
Isn't that the way we spoke with, like, and I hate to call Leinster, like, I hate saying that they're kind of South African led just because Jack came in there, but like, you know, when Munster did it to the Lions, they were very fearful of what, well, I wouldn't say fearful, but they were very aware of what the Lions can do, especially at home, and they control the ball around like they did to Leinster the week before. Yeah. Munster had a game plan which was very South African style. It's not, I suppose South Africa have used that kind of style in the World Cup and everything, and you think that they play no rugby, but like Johnny said, on transition, you know, a couple of passes, Lucanio Am or someone, like we've seen it plenty of times, and they just pounce. So you could see that kind of, that's why, I mean, is it not going to be free-flowing attack? Like, will Leinster bring quite a strict game plan on boxing Toulouse in and waiting till they get their own opportunity to pounce in a couple of phases? Like, it's going to be a very interesting strategic battle.
Something a lot of people have been talking about for the last couple of weeks is the battle of the scrum halves. Because I think we probably have the two form scrum halves in the world. I think if Antoine Dupont, like, the only reason Jameson Gibson-Park isn't the best scrum half in the world right now is because Antoine Dupont exists, and he probably is just the best player in the world all around. Brilliant, two excellent players and a brilliant individual matchup we're looking forward to seeing. But specifically on Dupont, Johnny Holland, how do you get the balance right between, and I'm not specifically talking even about Dupont, but like as a coach, if one team you're going up against has a specific player who is just so transcendent and is capable of so much and turning a game instantly, how do you put the adequate amount of preparation into dealing with him without also forgetting the fact that there are 14 other very, very good players out there? And if you put too much attention into stopping your Antoine Dupont, Roman Entomac can do something, or, you know, Cyril Bai can do something, or Juan Cruz Malia, or I could keep listing out names here all day, or Thomas Ramos. You know, how do you get that balance right?
I think it starts from the inside anyway, so your attention has to start with Dupont. So like, to not give him enough attention would be the biggest mistake. I think you have to give him the attention he deserves, and I think like the elephant in the room for Leinster is like, how do we stop Antoine Dupont? Like, you know, there's no two ways around it. So the way they've been setting up their game recently, I think is what they're going to do anyway. Disrupt the flow of the ball, disrupt them at the breakdown, try and put him off his stride a small bit. That is where he's actually most dangerous, so they have to be careful of that. But I think they'll give up a bit on the edge to try and box in Dupont, Intermac, and then Peter Aki in his kind of Bundy Aki style, you know, get them over the gain line, make something happen with a bit of play as well. Like, you know, so I do think you have to stop them from the inside out. And give Dupont the attention that he deserves. Like, otherwise you're going to kick yourself for not doing it. And I don't think you can talk him up enough. I think you have to, with discipline, you have to roil your players up enough. Like, who's going to get him for us? Like, you know, who's going to go and stop that guy? Because if we don't, the game is going to be gone from you.
Johnny?
Yeah, I think they're going to have a clear tactic around trying to swarm him around the breakdown, you know, as you said before. And that's where it's going to come down to. But he's a generational player. It's going to be very hard to try and not let him have an influence on the game. But how much of an influence he has on the game will decide where it goes.
Yeah. Is it so? Is it like, do you have to be realistic and say he is going to have a couple of moments in the game, but let's manage him rather than try to outright stop him?
Exactly. It's just like you said. You said a couple of minutes ago around, oh, you know, Leinster aren't going to keep them at no tries. Toulouse are going to score.
Yeah.
You know, that's the reality. So you have to just manage that. And then when he does have a moment, don't let it suck the momentum out of you. just say, okay, that's fine. He's got his moment. We stick to what our plan is, stick to script, and then keep going at him. But you know, they're not going to be able to give him time and space around that ruck, let have runners. And then also, particularly, and Gimson Park is brilliant at it as well, is that you know, those lines off line breaks, like those support lines he had, someone's going to have to try and pick him up, whether be it a blind winger or whether they're going to change their defense slightly and have someone in behind the front line, that if they do make a break, that he can be marshalled. That's really, really, really important.
Couple of last little bits then before I get a verdict off E. On team selection. Johnny Holland, I'll go to you first. 6-2 or 5-3 split on the bench? I'm gonna ask more so what you think will happen rather than what you would prefer to see happen, if you get me.
Yeah, I think 6-2, like against French sides like that. La Rochelle was a 6-2, wasn't it? I think you just have to deal with the power up front. Otherwise, again, you're going to be kicking yourself, because you'd like to think that they've had fitness and a lack of injuries in the back line where they're going to manage themselves, you know, and you're asking fellas to go a bit deeper for you because you've got one less change. Obviously, it brings risk, but I think if you have, that's why I think Cormac Foley could be a bit of a an outlier. I know people are already thinking about him. I'm not unique in that sense, but he's shown in the last couple of weeks that he can go onto the wing quite comfortably. You obviously don't want that happening, but it might happen, and you need a fellow who's comfortable enough. And Andy Farrell went back to those kind of ways of training people everywhere, and then all of a sudden you get yourself out of a hole. So I think he might be a key part of that. But also, you spoke with Anton Dupont. You need two man markers. You need two sevens, and you're going to have to swap them in like they have done in the past, like Will Connors and Josh van der Fleer, whoever starts. I think the other one will bring energy. So that's why I think, like, when you're going with a full front row, and then you're going to have a second row and a back row, like, that's already five. Do you want one more just to make sure you deal with the power and what they're going to bring off the bench as well? Because, you know, we speak about Leinster's hookers. Toulouse have both of them. Like, you speak of their front row.
Afu and Marchand.
Toulouse have that. They've loads of second rows. They've got a lot of firepower. So I think when you're for 5-3, and like, a lot of time backs are influential, and you feel like you're making a change sometimes for the sake of it. You don't really want to fully go for it, but you think, oh, I'll change it up with someone, they might bring a spark. That's grand when you can match them up front. But if you haven't matched them up front yet, that seems like a bit of a waste. And that's why I think they'd go to 6-2 instead. Jimmy O'Brien's going to be unbelievably unlucky there. He's brought some spark in the last couple of weeks, but you have to have an out-and-out cover at 10 where Kieran Frawley will do that, you know.
And then the other part on it, you kind of brought it up yourself then as well. Considering how well it worked having Will Connors starting and Josh van der Fleer on the bench against La Rochelle, and considering Toulouse have equally big forwards and big ball carriers, the likes of Emmanuel Meafu, who would, you know, rank side by side with a Will Skelton. Is Will Connors your man to start and have Josh van der Fleer on the bench, or are you sticking with what would traditionally be the first choice?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think they'll stick with Josh van der Fleer. I think they were very, there were certain personnel with La Rochelle that I think they were just standout. You know, I don't think Toulouse have the same kind of, they don't have the same marksman because they're all at it, you know. So I don't think you can just go, obviously we spoke with Dupont and Intermac and stuff like that, but like, you know, I'm talking about up front. Yeah. You don't have the Winnie Antonio, the Will Skelton. They have plenty, by the way, but I just don't know if it's the exact same situation. So I think they might go Josh van der Fleer.
So Johnny Murphy then, 6-2 or 5-3, and then...
I actually, just from what Johnny said there, I think they might go 5-3 with Jimmy on the bench because it just gives them a bit more rotation. And I think with Hugo Keenan back, then Frawley might miss out with Harry Byrne on the bench because Jimmy covers, you know, obviously 12 or 13 out. It doesn't look like Ringrose is going to make it. I just, like, they have guys that are incredibly powerful. Yes, like, they do. But they don't have the same just massive brawn, in my opinion, that La Rochelle do. And I think that could give them that chance. But for me, I think 5-3 because of that, and John and van der Fleer starts. You know, so yeah, and then yeah, it's just so hard to call, but like, that's kind of what. But then I do think that Cormac Foley probably does make it if they go 6-2, you know, because of his ability just to move around, you know.
Final point on this game then, and I'm only taking one word answers: Leinster or Toulouse. Johnny Holland, you go first.
Leinster.
Johnny Murphy.
Leinster.
I'm leaning to lose. I've been afraid of them all season. I'm leaning to lose. We'll move on though, and we'll start in looking at the URC recap. And because we were talking about Leinster, it makes sense to come in here with Ulster, who, I mean, just Johnny Hanlon, like, what a brilliant and what an important victory it is for them. Four wins in a row in the URC now. Their playoff spot is secure. They're still waiting to see, is it going to be enough for Champions Cup? Because we have to wait and see. First of all, do the Sharks win the Challenge Cup and take one of those Champions Cup spots? But either way, they're right in with a shout heading into the last round here. And I'm coming to you first, obviously, because you want a victory lap after being a little bit more positive on Ulster than Bernard Jackman was last week.
I just thought there was a bit of distraction in Leinster, and I thought Ulster were... was too much of a psychological advantage for them to have to turn up. And
it felt like for Ulster, this game had been marked down in the calendars about a month ago.
Yeah, it was just one of those powerful ones. I think, like, you see the scenes afterwards, and there just seemed to be a big, they turned the corner definitely in what their belief might have been. And we spoke last week about, you know, will they sneak into a position? But I can guarantee you that team is thinking, we'll shock everyone. You know, there's an upward curve. Richie is obviously working wonders at the moment with team morale. I think it was interesting. You see Will Addison giving him a little tap in the arse afterwards. He's been let go, and they're hugging and embracing. And I'd say it feels good after that win, you know. And that's what you're hoping for—a bit of a statement win. I know it's not Leinster's first team, but no one cares. Anytime you beat Leinster, it's a very good day. So,
look at Munster last year in the semi-final. No one, like, that was, you know, we've all been talking about how that wasn't a first Leinster team, but nobody cared when Munster beat them in a semi-final last year.
Because that team beats everyone all the time. So now the tide is turning a small bit, that Leinster are going to have to put out their first team to beat you. You know, that's what teams are thinking, because you can beat them. But I think it was just the way Ulster played. Like, they had a couple of line breaks and near tries in the first 10 minutes that they should be finishing. You know, there was it John Cooney went through and didn't find the pass? Or who went through? Was it John Cooney? Didn't find a pass on the outside. And it was a walk-in, I think. And then the Mike Lowry stuff... Will Addison getting held up, they were worth more tries than that. I think they just played really good rugby, and they were dominant in the first quarter. Obviously, they got picked apart very quickly as well by Leinster to give away that dominance. But to have the fight to come back against a team like Leinster, who are normally dominant, I know you're at home and it's the last time at home and everything else, the psychological stuff comes into it. But the fight from Tom Stewart after a silly penalty into a poached penalty for himself made that Leinster decision the wrong one. And then... the balls and John Cooney to go and kick that. I know we all knew he was going to, but they won that kick battle beforehand.
Yeah.
You know, they went slightly back into their own half, but they trusted it. And, you know, I think Nick Timoney's been highlighted in that sequence of kind of doing a lot of work. The amount of stuff that adds up to get a win like that, you know, it can't go unnoticed. And that comes from coaches embedding it into the players, but the players going and carrying it as well. I just think it was a very, very good performance.
Johnny, yeah, specifically on John Cooney, actually, just for a second, I don't know, is there a player in the last 5 to 10 years that I would have banked more to make that kick at the end than him? He just consistently seems to just love those big kicks in pressure moments, and he has done it so many times for Ulster down the years.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, he's probably someone that, you know, Irish, should we look back and say, could he have had more caps? I know it's been a very competitive nine space, but could he have been in the squads a few more times and been given those opportunities? But the minute that penalty was given, you knew that he was like, this is my moment, I'm good. And those moments are big to him. You know, his character aligns himself with standing up to those opportunities and knocking them over. And yeah, there was no doubt when he got the ball that it was like, yeah, that's going over. You know, just watching it, I knew that was it. It was game done.
He was celebrating on his touchline conversion as well, like giving it to the crowd. And I think when you're a younger kicker, you don't want to kick those, like, you know. And I think when you get, you maybe miss one or two, or you get a small bit older, you're like, these are what people know me for. This is how people are going to know me. And if I'm going to stand up at all, like, I might as well kick it. You know, what's the worst that can happen in one sense? But John, you've said it there. John Cooney just seems to love stepping up, like, you know, and celebration afterwards, a good night, everything else going with it. He's just confident, like, isn't he?
Yeah, his Instagram is actually great. He does a lot of really, really interesting stuff around kicking and just kind of talking around the process of it. Even for an old J5 prop like myself, I can still appreciate the content in it. So well worth a follow is John Cooney on Instagram. Moving on, I'll talk about Munster now. First, before I talk about their win against Edinburgh on Friday night, which has actually put them top of the table now and in control of their own destiny, right through potentially for a home final if they can get all the way. But the big news yesterday, fellas, Simon Zeebo confirmed his retirement, someone both of you would have played with at Munster down the years. Munster's record try scorer, 72 tries. He's played more than 250 games between Munster Racing 92 and Ireland. And I don't know which of you wants to jump in first, but just ultimately he's leaving behind a whopper of a legacy.
Yeah, I think Zeeb's probably changed the way how people could behave. I think in all honesty, you know, we were part of a group when Johnny started and when Zeeb started that, you know, was an aging group, and it was very clear, you know, you have to do this, this and this to be a rugby player or to be a Munster rugby player. And that was the way it was. And that's fine. But I think Zeeb's led the change for people to be themselves, people to be, for people outside to understand that, you know, preparing yourself for a game is individual and you have to find what your niche is. You have to find how you want to do weights in the weights room on a Monday and Tuesday, and be accepting of that, and also get behind that. And but one of my lasting memories is actually of in the old CIT gym of, and this is actually true. People are going to think I'm just saying it because Johnny's on the.
I love a story that begins with "This is actually true."
Yeah, but it's actually Johnny Holland and Simon Zeebo having a dance off in the middle of the of the running lane in the middle of the gym in CIT. And my memory is like, obviously everyone knows Zeebs can dance, but I was like, oh my God, Johnny Holland's got some moves.
Happening here.
But like, it was stuff like that, that just, you know, made him be fun to be around. And a room was always, there was more smiles in a room when he was there, when he wasn't there. And I think that's what leaves his legacy is going to be off the pitch, that people can be themselves and be what they are, which is brilliant. On the pitch, unbelievable to play with. As a fullback or when he was on the wing or when he was fullback and you were on the wing, his chat, his skill level, his left foot, like just, you know, brilliant. And like, it wasn't all plain sailing for him. Like he nearly got released out of an academy contract very, very early. Fought hard, worked hard on his fitness, did everything, but like started with a bang, and hopefully he'll finish with a bang too.
Johnny Holland.
Yeah, everyone gets caught up in the Zeebo hype train from time to time, but the fact that, like, you know, I only thought about it yesterday. I was watching a couple of videos of him, and I actually texted him yesterday, being like, no, like, heartbreak, you know, don't do it now. But he has his own celebration. Like, I know Owen Farrell has a celebration, there's a story behind it. Zeebo's celebration is as Z for him,
yeah,
from him to the crowd. That'll tell you enough about the guy. Do you know what I mean? And he doesn't act like, if anyone else had a celebration, you'd be laughed out of the country. Like, but if you try to laugh at Simon Zeebo, he's like, "What's your point? Like, you know, this is me." And
he's not going to be offended. You
no,
know?
Like you're the bigger fool for even asking him to stop. Like, and Johnny was me saying the Lions year when he got called out afterwards. I think for a lot of that year, he was calling himself the Cub, and people would be like, "What are you doing?" He's like, "Soon to be a Lion." Like he made that happen. Like he got on that plane, regardless of whether they liked it or not. Like, you know, so that's who you're dealing with. But you know, there was times I remember being in the gym, in that CIT gym, and he was doing weights with me, and I'm a smaller fella. Like, and remember Ivan Dineen being like, "What are you doing? Like, you know, lift some proper weights." Insulting to me, but whatever. And Zeebo just went over and picked up Ivan's weights and bashed him out and was like, "Yeah, shut up, like I'm doing my own thing." You know, and that's who you're dealing with. Like, if you get, you know, people don't like everything that he's done and how he's managed himself around the game and whatever else, but like, you know, that's your own issue. Like, if you take it personally at all, like he's gonna have the last laugh. But he, like, whatever with all those stories. I remember talking to, I coached with Duncan Williams last year, and so we would have chatted quite a bit about the game. And he wouldn't play much last year and all the rest of it. And people might have, like Johnny said, like I always find it interesting. People like Conor Murray, Simon Zeebo, very, very top of the game. Like, you know, There's rarely a player is going to do more than them, and they still get abuse at a certain stages of their career. And I remember Duncan just saying to me, like, no one understands how good this guy is in terms of, like, what Johnny said, his chat, his organization, his defense, his defensive reads. They don't understand how good he actually is, you know. So I just think he's unbelievable. Like, you see a lot of tributes to him in the last couple of days, like, that the game is going to be different because of him. He made people smile, changed the game, like Johnny said as well. He absolutely did, you know. So players like that don't come around often, and I think he's worthy of all the outpouring and more.
Yeah, and like what one of the I would say one of the highlights I've had in the near 3 years now that I've been working with RT it was the first game of the 2021-22 season. So it was Zeebo's first game back at Thomond Park. There was supporters finally allowed back in Thomond Park as well at the start of that season. Only about 10,000, I think. And for that first game, Simon Zeebo's big return, 5.5 minutes in, loose ball on the touchline. He picks it up and sprints in 60 meters for a try. And honestly, like there was only 10,000 people in Thomond Park, and maybe it was the fact that I hadn't been at a game with supporters in it for so long. But the place felt so loud, and it just was one of those like, wow, this is a genuinely brilliant moment to see, because I think very few players in the last 10, 15 years have connected with the Munster fans as Simon Zeebo has. So yeah, it was a brilliant moment to see, and best of luck to him in his retirement. Before we finish up as well, obviously Connacht, their playoff hopes are not officially over, but are all but over, you would have to say. They're going to have to beat Leinster with a bonus point in just over a week's time and hope for results elsewhere to go their ways. That's after losing 16-12 against the Stormers. It was actually a really, really enjoyable game, I thought, on Saturday. Johnny Holland, I'll go to you. Connacht, look, they went down against the Stormers and they were frustrated at missing a few chances, but in fairness to them, they went down fighting. It was a really, really good game, and I thought the intensity and physicality of it was absolutely ferocious. They're unlikely now to make the top eight, but I don't know. I still think there's something there for them. And I think, as we discussed last week, are they potentially a little bit better off not being in the Champions Cup next season?
Yeah, it's very hard to say that, but like they possibly would be, you know,
Yeah.
let them build again. But like Stormers and Connacht was never going to be 16-12, was it? Like, what
Yeah.
happened there? But obviously there's a lot that you can take out of that. The Pete Wilkins can say, like, we defended really well. The Stormers were forced to take two penalties at goal to win the game. Like, and I don't think you can say that quite a bit. You know, Manny Labock obviously kicked in the sports ground, the Dexcom Stadium now, with the wind and everything else that goes with it. So maybe he stepped up a small bit and kind of proved himself. I didn't like the flight on his ball. That's a story for another day. I'll let John Cooney get into that on his Instagram. I think he's a bit choppy at the ball, but I'm not Manny Labock, so maybe I'll leave it there. But you know, I think there's enough for them to go by. But like, even the strength off the bench, like, were they really going to go on and win that game? If we look at what Munster have at the moment, obviously what Leinster churn out every week, you know, you're going to need a squad 23 plus now, you know, and be able to change that weekly to be able to go and chase teams like the Stormers and qualification.
And then,
Yeah, I
like
think
Johnny
that
Murphy, ultimately, like the damage for them, it wasn't done against the Stormers on Saturday by losing to, you know, a URC title contender. The damage was done a month ago when they were hammered at home against the Lions. The damage was done earlier on in the season when they lost in the last minute at Edinburgh, having pulled themselves back into a drawn situation. The damage has been at various stages throughout the season, rather than a narrow losing bonus point defeat against one of the best teams in the league.
Yeah, I think it's the lack of consistency, I think, across the board that they've had. And I think that Saturday was probably a microcosm of what's happened throughout the whole year. You know, they get an opportunity to a penalty, go to the corner, and then literally a couple of guys fall over each other, line out in 5 meters. You know, like, okay, but their movement was wrong before the slip happens. You know, it's that consistency at that level throughout the whole season that has hurt them. And that was, you know, they were the crucial moments, you know, twice or three times this weekend that hurt them. But that's just been the story of their season. You know, they're releasing a lot of players. They've invested in youth. They're building an academy. You know, they've signed a couple of good academy guys and local academy guys that have come through this year, and that development. So they're probably, a year in the, no one wants to be in the, in the, out of the Champions Cup, but at the same time, they sit in the Challenge Cup, but they, it's an opportunity for those younger players and everyone they're building in to build on and kick on. And, they're a team that could win that. If they get a consistency right, it's an opportunity to win a trophy. And hopefully this is only the start for that transition that they're going through after releasing so many players this year.
Yeah, and then like just to finish up then on the subject of that, where there's a massive turnover of players, excuse me, 11 players leaving this summer. And I was looking back through it at the last week where the top six of those players in terms of experience have more than 700 appearances for Connacht. Like that is an enormous amount of experience to be losing from a squad. Next season's first team squad is going to have six players there that have played more than 100 games for the province. I had a quick look at Munster's squad there last week, and they have 14 players in their current squad who have more than 100 games for Munster. So that's just to put it into context, the gulf of experience that they're going to be losing next season. One thing, obviously, then they haven't been helped with, Johnny Holland, is injuries and JJ Hanrahan's ACL injury, which we spoke about last week as well. It has led to this rumor that has kind of turned into a great oak tree from a tiny acorn just a few days ago about them making an approach to go after Sam Prendergast on a loan deal for next season if JJ Hanrahan isn't going to be available this side of Christmas. How do you see that one? Like, I'll come to Johnny Murphy in a moment, because I know he obviously has coached Sam down the years as well and stuff like that. But do you think a player like Sam Prendergast probably would benefit from getting out there and even getting half a season's worth of games for Connacht?
I'm torn on it because I do think getting more game time, like we kind of spoke about it earlier, much earlier in the podcast, but getting a run of games makes a player different. Definitely kind of allows them to grow up and take a leadership role. But I just so I think it would be a good move, and I think if all parties are in agreement, I think it would be great for him to get some games. But at the same time, like we saw Jack Crowley having an offer from La Rochelle, and at times you could have thought, Jesus, should he have gone there? He didn't look like he was about to step through at Munster, and in a season he was an international. So you might miss a window or a chance. You don't know what's going to happen, and it's very, very hard to go away from Leinster at the moment. I don't think he's going to want to leave Leinster. Like I if you're Sam Prendergast and you're looking at Harry and Ross Byrne, you surely think you're going to take them on. And if you take on that competition, you are number one, and you're in a driving seat to take on Jack Crowley for Ireland's number one. So that's the level of depth you have to go to in terms of understanding his conversations, but his thought process around whether he wants to take that or not. Obviously, Connacht's a little bit of an easier one, going over to his brother and maybe getting a connection there. But it's very, very hard to tell a fella where to go. Like I'm, you know, Ross has been quite good. Ross Byrne has been quite good in Leinster, but he's definitely left gaps in his game that a younger fella would think I can do that. And I think Harry even more so. So I think Sam Prendergast, with a pre-season and a fresh start at the new season, he'd be thinking he should take that position. So trying to force him over to Connacht is a very hard one.
Yeah, and Johnny, like, I know you obviously have a personal relationship with him, so I'm not sure how much you'd want to comment about, where he should be going or what he should be doing. What general thoughts would you have on it?
Yeah, just to start off, I haven't spoke to him at all about it, so I don't know. The first I heard about it was obviously through kind of what was being said over the last couple of days, and I haven't spoken to him about it at all, so I genuinely don't have a clue what's going on. Yeah, it's a very hard one to decide. There's a lot more at stake than just an individual as well, like a loan period. How long is it for? Is he going to go to a rival province for, until Christmas and then come back and know all their plays, know everything? Historically in England, a lot of guys would have, when I was there, would have gone on loan, but generally to championship sides. Billy Twelvetrees went to Bedford, Dan Cole went to Bedford, Tom Youngs went to Nottingham, but they're different leagues. So, and you're still in complete control of them. They train a couple of days a week with you, where a loan thing, it's never really been done for a short period of time and a short contract. Within the IRFU. So there's a lot more at stake than it's, than what people are saying. Oh, it's simple. They have an injury. Send them there. He'll figure it out. But how long for? What's the parameters? And then ultimately it comes down to, does Sam want to do it? What are the conversations he's having with Leo and Jack around potential game time in the future? And also, are you going to back yourself that, is he going to back himself that an injury, which can happen at any time, and he's going to be involved in every single 23, every game? And that's where he's at the moment. If someone gets injured, he's probably going to be on the bench. If they, you know, so I think that's it's a decision he's going to have to make. But I don't even know whether they've had the conversation, whether it's just out of someone just saying it in the media, and it's, you know, so who knows?
Yeah, sometimes these rumors do come up because a pundit says, do you know what, wouldn't it be great for Sam Prendergast to go on loan to Connacht and get a good bit of game time? And then Leo Cullen gets asked about it. What do you think about Sam Prendergast going away to get some game time? And he denies it. And then there's a headline, Leo Cullen denies rumor that Sam Prendergast is heading to Connacht or something like that. But the other part of it then to consider, Johnny Holland, is like from Leinster's point of view, they might be quite reluctant to you know, agree to a loan deal like that for a player to head out when there's still a few games left in this season to figure out, and there's a summer tour coming up of South Africa. And if they have agreed to send an out half out on loan for the first few months of next season, and Kieran Frawley and Ross Byrne pick up injuries playing with Ireland in South Africa, all of a sudden Leinster are kind of scrambling around.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
They might be willing to take that risk.
Yeah, and they'd be more than entitled to do that. Like, so then that, in that sense, Sam Prendergast needs to say, I want to go, you know, and then you're starting to get
or I don't want to.
Yeah, but you're getting into messy territory there then, where it could be forever, you know, and he doesn't want to do that, I'd say. So like, no, it's a hard one, and I'd love to know the details of it, but none of us do. I can see why people say it, but it, like Johnny said, it's not as simple as just sending someone up there, play a couple of games and come back. You know, everything to do with them, their intel is after being spread across Ireland. So it's yeah, we let it play out. If I was him and I saw the opportunity in Leinster for that 10 jersey with the credit that he has, with the potential and what I believe his coaches think about him, the way they're using him as a young fella, I think he'll stick, but I don't know anything. So we'll see.
All right. I don't think this one's going to be decided in the next couple of days anyway, so we'll probably be having this debate again. Johnny Murphy and Johnny Holland, thanks a million for joining us. A reminder, Leinster and Toulouse in the Investec Champions Cup final is live on Saturday from 2 o'clock. Coverage gets underway on RT2 and RT Player. And we'll also have a live blog on RT.ie. And you can listen to live commentary as well on the radio, Saturday Sport on RT Radio 1. Fellas, thanks a million, and we'll speak to you all again soon.